Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own, and we're thankful for the support of our patrons. Truly, you make what we do here possible. Your contributions keep the conversation going, and always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 388 of Registry Matters. Larry, it's another fine Saturday evening. This recording is 9/5, so September 5th. Holy moly, it's Labor Day weekend. Can you imagine? Where's the year gone?
Yeah, just for correction, it's 387, and hopefully you're on the right program outline on 387.
Right row.
388's already in there, but that's not the one we're doing.
Well, then that would have made life very, very, very challenging for me.
So,
yeah.
Right. So we're on 387 of Registry Matters. Doing awesome. How are you?
I am fine. I'm going to have to pause for a moment because I need to load the right thing.
Oh, I can.
Oh my God! It's asking me to sign in.
So yes. Yeah, so we're going to be doing an episode tonight about a case from the United States Court of Appeals from the Seventh Circuit, and I can't pronounce it, but I'm going to do the best I can. United States versus Anderegg, A-N-D-E-R-E-G-G. And it's a win for the team. And then we're going to be having some of my favorite conversation. We're going to be talking about politics and how you evaluate a legislator, if they can be effective, and if they're worthy of working with. And so we're going to go over some points. This was thrown at me the last minute, but since this is my profession, I can actually do it with very little notice. So this is what we're doing tonight. And so now I can hand it back to my co-host, who's finally on the right screen.
I think I am. Yes. Okay. 387. Well, you know, I looked for the most recent document. It's 388. Wasn't paying any attention. I opened it. So poof, that's how we got there. All right. Well,
an Indiana man finished his 10 years on the registry. Then the state decided lifetime sounded better. So he sued. No lawyer, no firm, no money behind him. And a federal judge handed him an injunction. Andy and Larry walked through exactly how he pulled it off. Even $1 a month unlocks everything this show has. Become a patron at patreon.com/registrymatters.
One of my very good friends, he is out in the Colorado area, and he said, we have a constituent whose husband was incarcerated and on the registry, and she thinks this guy, Rod Pelton, would be open to carrying a bill to make the registry have a path off in Colorado. Ha ha ha, smirk, 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 he said. So my question is, how do you do an evaluation of a politician to determine if they'd be your advocate or not? So, and I'm thinking, I don't know if it was maybe like 2 months ago, we had almost like the equivalent question. It was like somebody in Kansas or something like that, out in a rural area. And you looked him up and he's like, this guy can't do anything. He hasn't. He's your representative. Yes, he can introduce it, but he has never carried a bill anywhere. He's never passed one through. So did that frame it? Did I explain that sort of right?
You did. And boy, you're going to be shocked. And so is the audience, because if I had the opportunity to vote for this legislator, Senator Rod Pelton, I would do so. Without any hesitation.
But he's a Republican.
Doesn't matter. I'm policy driven. And this, I mean, we can go through bit by bit, piece by piece of what you'd look at. So one of the first things you want to look at when you're evaluating a politician is, can they pass any legislation? Well, I looked up his 2026 legislative history. And he has either sponsored or co-sponsored 26 bills that made it to the governor and they were signed by the governor. Now, if Colorado does things the same way we do, the first name on the list is usually the lead sponsor whose legislation it is. And then the second and any subsequent name is usually a co-sponsor. I won't make that assumption because I've never practiced in Colorado, but I would see no logic in it being different. But then when you look on the co-sponsors, you look at who those co-sponsors are. And the bills that I bothered to click on the co-sponsors, he has worked in a bipartisan fashion. to pass legislation. And he's not working with just the backbenchers, the people that just started yesterday. He's working with the president of the Senate, the majority leader of the Senate. He has no hesitation to work in a bipartisan fashion to get things done. And his record demonstrates that he is actually getting things done. 26 bills to the governor, signed by the governor in one session.
So, can I have a question then. What does it take to be a co-sponsor? Isn't it just like, yeah, I agree, I would like to put my name on it? Like, what does co-sponsor mean?
Well, you got a good question there. And what that's essentially about all it means. And I can't speak for Colorado, but in New Mexico, practically anybody can put themselves down as a co-sponsor. But the way it works is if you're in a hyper-partisan situation, a person doesn't want a co-sponsor, it's going to sink their bill. You want a co-sponsor, okay. It's going to help your bill. So if Rod Pelton goes and co-sponsors a Democratic bill, the Democrats might feel that that would be a hindrance to their bill. But he has worked in a bipartisan fashion to pass 26 pieces of legislation, which some of them appear to be sponsored by him, his bills. And the Democrats are in strong control. They have practically super majorities.
Okay.
They don't need Rod Pelton at all. So if he sponsors something, all they've got to do is say, gee, pretty good piece of legislation. They get one of their Democratic members to sponsor the same thing, and his bill sits and sits and sits and sits and sits and sits. They didn't do that to him. That tells me he's well respected by the majority party.
We had a conversation during the week since you brought it up here. You said that a supermajority, in your opinion, is bad. I understand why you would say that, but I think that the majority of people in the United States want supermajority so they can push everything that they want through, because it's what they want. It's not what would necessarily be good and compromise and whatnot. But you've also bashed partisanship.
I bash partisanship all the time.
I can't get a straight answer out of you.
I think I'm giving you a straight answer. I'm not understanding. I bash partisanship every chance I get. So I'm at a loss to understand your question.
Well, you want this guy's being bipartisan. I'm sorry, not partisans. I'm sorry. I totally meant bipartisan, because if we have bipartisan, then we have compromise. We have not everybody's happy, but something got through, and you have bashed bipartisanship.
No, then you're misunderstanding my bashing. My criticism is just because something is bipartisan, that doesn't necessarily make it good.
Okay.
It can be good, but bipartisan bad legislation gets through, like a lot of the PFR stuff, because you can't oppose it politically. So if it passes 100-0 and it's bad public policy, that just because it's bipartisan doesn't mean it's good.
Sure.
So, but I praise bipartisanship if it results in good legislation. If you have a lopsided majority, there's no need to compromise. You can tell the minority party, go F yourself.
I saw that coming.
And that means that you don't have to make any compromise whatsoever. You can look at them and say, well, you can have your 3 minutes or whatever the rules allow. And when you're done, we're going to vote you down. When you don't have a supermajority, oftentimes you're forced to listen to countervailing points of view, and you have to stick things in legislation that you wouldn't have put in there if it was all done by your party. And your party isn't necessarily right about everything.
But so, yeah, I think most people in the United States think that just straight up the other party is bad, regardless of whether you're on Team Blue or Team Red. The other party is bad, just like a Georgia-Florida game.
Well, with our 900,000 subscribers, I'm trying to convince people that's wrong.
Yes.
And so I'm demonstrating that tonight. But beyond his ability, then you've asked yourself the question, can he get anything done? And we've answered that question. Then you ask the next question, does he have the political capital that he can afford to take a little bit of risk? So then you go look at his electoral history. I went back far enough, I don't see that he's ever had less than 70 to 73% margin
Oh, okay. So he's elected very, very heavily.
Yeah, that tells me that he's got a little bit of capital to burn. That doesn't mean he wants to burn it on PFRs, but he could. A person that won by 50.4% to 49.6% has no capital to put at risk. So Senator Pelton, having resounding electoral majorities, he can take risks that few politicians can take. So those are the two primary things that I look at. Then the other stuff I can look at without even looking at it. If he were a klutz and didn't know how to speak eloquently and didn't treat his colleagues collegially and with respect, he would not be able to pass 26 bills, whether he's sponsor or co-sponsor. So that tells me he's a reasonable, patient person that you can talk to and reason with. So I know all I need to know about him from a half hour worth of research today, that I would say that he's probably leans more the Democratic. You look at his legislative list of what he has passed, and the titles of the bills tell you an awful lot about, you know, stuff that he's doing. You know, that it's not all just right-wing fanatic stuff. So you know, healthcare payment programs. I didn't have a chance to get into all the nuances of the bills, but he's doing stuff that would typically be more progressive. And like I say, and his constituents don't realize that. There's one called this obviously is a co-sponsor because it originated in the House. House Bill 26-1325, Natural Medicine. Well, although he didn't sponsor that, it started in the House. He was open-minded enough to do something with natural medicine. That's usually coming from the pointy head side of the aisle. And then there's another one. It was a House bill that he co-sponsored in the Senate, changes to practices relating to death. I don't know what that's about, but it sounds like it might be something that's more pointy-headed. So access to veterinary care. A lot of these bills that he co-sponsored, they have to get introduced into the Senate after they pass the House. It's great that you can pass it out of one chamber, but it needs sponsorship on the other side.
Tell me about the committee membership he has, because he is, I'm seeing a bunch of bills related to animal stuff. So like the access to veterinary care, there's another one up there about something about stolen livestock. But I see that his committees are the veterans, but I see he's on the agricultural committee.
And natural resources, yes.
Right. And so does it help if he's on the legislative audit committee or, you know, legislative anything like that?
I don't know what the audit committee does, but those are good committee assignments. But he's a very moderate Republican, kind of like what has largely vanished from the Republican Party and what's kind of largely vanished from the Democrat Party. You know, they've moved so far into polarization, but this is a very moderate, pragmatic Republican like I used to enjoy working with back in the 70s and 80s.
Would you put him sort of on a similar playing field to, what was it, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, being in a super red state, but he was a Democrat?
Yes, that would be the same type of person. And Joe Manchin's not very welcome in the Democrat Party. So they lost their majorityship because they were so bullheaded that they wanted Manchin out of there. And they ended
Even
up turning
they had,
over the seat.
They had somebody sitting there on their caucus.
Yes, who was always going to vote with them on organizational matters, on things where it really mattered in terms of running the Senate. He was actually not. I think he declared himself independent toward the end. But he was voting organizationally with the Democrats, and they were too damn dumb to understand that.
Very well. Any final points here?
I think that if Colorado needs any help, I'd be delighted to work with Senator Pelton if he's amenable. And he's got all the necessary makeup to be able to do this, if you can convince him that it's something that he wants to do. So you got to look at all those counties that he's covering. Part of his district covers a whole bunch of counties. You need to find somebody who's on the PFR list, and maybe that they, or maybe even in the county that he hails from. And then you might have a constituent who could approach him. But yes, I would think he'd be a very good resource.
Very good.
Cameras on ordinary street corners photograph every car that passes, and a private company keeps the pictures. Larry's point is the uncomfortable one. A car never proves who was driving it, and a registry is just another status list waiting to be searched. That conversation keeps going in patron-only bonus content you will not hear on the public feed. Become a patron at patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, well, before we get into it, I'm going to try to lay this one out a little bit, because I read this one twice while I was on the public train today going downtown. And I still want you to tell me where I've got it wrong, because from what I can tell from my like minuscule brain reading, the government lost. And this is the Seventh Circuit panel held that a federal child porn statute is unconstitutional. So on its face, it looks like this is a huge win for the defense. Is that, did I have that right?
Yeah, yeah, so far, but I'm not sure what prawn is. Can you enlighten the audience here?
No, I cannot. So okay. The court said, and I'm reading it, quote, we conclude that 1466A subsection B paragraph 1 is unconstitutional as applied to Andereg. Are we pronouncing that Andereg?
That's what I'm going with.
Perfect. All right. And then and that's end quote. They affirmed the decision made by the trial judge. And so walk me through why I feel like I should be more excited about this than I actually am.
Well, I'm generally pleased with to see the panel, what they did with this decision. And we're going to spend some time on why they did what they did. But let's try to bring you back from the ledge just a little bit before you jump. You're reading correctly, but you left out three words that matter more than the rest of the sentence. It says applied to Andereg. So this is an applied ruling on one count. And then we get back into procedural posture. You're going to see when we slice and dice this bigger pie that the government still has a nice fork in it.
All right. Well, then I'm going to do the procedural thing. Andereg was charged with four counts. And the way the opinion describes it, he was charged with, quote, knowingly producing, end quote, knowingly distributing, visual depictions of minors engaged in naughty behavior. And now I said that I was quoting this, and now I've modified it, so really I'm not quoting it. But then he knowingly transferred such material to a minor under the age of 16. That's counts 1, 2, and 3. And then count 4 was this possession charge, quote, knowingly possessing at least one visual depiction that depicted a minor engaging in more naughty behavior. So again, I've ruined the quote. He moved to dismiss the whole indictment. And here's the key line, quote, the district court granted the motion as to the possession charge and denied the remainder. So the district judge threw out count 4 and kept counts 1, 2, and 3.
Great job. Keep going.
No. This is why you're here. Explain what happened at the trial court level, because I don't understand this stuff.
Okay. So the district court judge, who was actually chief judge, Peterson, out of the Western District of Wisconsin, dismissed only the possession count. He held it section 1466A(b)(1) unconstitutional as applied under Stanley versus Georgia, the 1969 case that says you have a First Amendment right to possess obscene material in the privacy of your own home. Then the government took what's called an interlocutory appeal, meaning they appealed the dismissal on that one count before the trial of the other three ever has begun. So the Seventh Circuit was only looking at count 4. Counts 1, 2, and 3, production, distribution, and transfer to minor, were never in front of them. So those are alive, and they're going to, I presume, proceed to trial.
But the government appealed. Can you explain to the audience what is an interlocutory appeal and what is the actual issue in this appeal?
Sure. Normally, a case can't be appealed until the conclusion. No, so neither normally a party cannot appeal until the conclusion of the case. So in essence, it's an appeal of a temporary or interim decision made by the judge. So the judge, in a pretrial motion, threw out that count, and the government said, "Wait a minute, what the? You did what?" And so that's what happened. And so an interlocutory appeal, they're rare. They're very narrowly available. And normally you don't get granted an interlocutory appeal, but it does not end the case. The actual question that was posed by the appeal was whether the First Amendment, for First Amendment purposes, obscene virtual CSAM, that I didn't explain what CSAM is.
Child sexual abuse material.
Is more akin to actual CSAM or just general obscene materials, you know, generally speaking, that would be permissible in our Western society.
Well, why does the government argue that it should?
The government argued that offenders may use obscene virtual CSAM to groom minors into engaging in sexually explicit conduct. They claim it is well known that the abusers utilize obscene images to groom their minor victims. Now, I've not heard this before, but that's what the government said.
They also argued as technological advances allow creators to render virtual images indistinguishable from real ones, virtual CSAM may come to pose more of a danger than the cartoons or video game references in Free Speech Coalition. How did that argument go?
Well, the COET stated, we cannot ignore the fact that the Supreme COET flatly rejected the same argument the government advances here. And they cited Free Speech Coalition, 535 U.S. at 251. And the Supreme Court's word, the government may not prohibit speech because it increases the chance an unlawful act will be committed at some indefinite future time. Now, you're going to have to admit that that's a funny quote.
I guess I'm trying to really, like, understand, but I'm really getting confused.
You're confused. Well, he won on the possession count. And the three others, he didn't win. So, like doctrinally, he won something real. And I don't want to shortchange what the panel did. But as a practical matter for this man, this defendant is still sitting in the Western District of Wisconsin. And the possession count was really the least of his worries. He's still facing production. He's facing distribution. He's facing transferring this material to a minor under 16. Those carry heavy exposure, I'm presuming. So getting the possession count knocked out is like getting a misdemeanor dropped while the felonies proceed. If you're keeping score at the courthouse, dismissing count four changes almost nothing about what happens to Mr. Anderegg. It changes a great deal about the law, people who are accused of computer-generated CSAM, but for this man itself, it's really mostly window dressing.
Well, so let's back up to the facts a little bit, because I think the trigger here is more ordinary than people would guess. This didn't start with some grand FBI operation. Tell me if I've got the chain right. Meta, which owns Instagram, filed a report. The opinion says in October 2023, Meta, quote, reported the online transmission of potential CSAM to the cyber trip line of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, otherwise known as NCMEC. An Instagram user apparently sent a direct message with what looked like AI-generated images to an account that belonged to a minor. And then, and this is the part that got me, quote, the responding message history showed the account user explaining to the minor how he had created the images by inputting text prompts into Stable Diffusion, a text-to-image generative AI model.
So, well, it seems like he told on himself.
Seems like it. Yeah.
That's the whole thing. This is a mundane trigger, a cyber tip line. I think you said trip line report out of Meta.
Oh, I did.
A direct message to a minor account. And the guy who then narrates his own methodology to the kiddie's messaging. That didn't even read right. Who the hell wrote this? Law enforcement linked the account to Anderegg. His resume said he was a software engineer with background in AI models. I guess that would explain how he knew what he was doing. They got a search warrant for his home, his laptop, two cell phones, and other devices. And then the government's allegation that he installed Stable Diffusion, added software components to give it ability to render human genitalia, and then, this is straight from the opinion, quote, used a curated text prompts to generate these images and further refine the output by employing negative prompts to exclude depictions of adults, end of quote. Negative prompts, I have no idea what that is. He was engineering out the adults so it would only produce children. That's the government's allegation. So what the heck are they talking about here?
Stable Diffusion is just like generating AI images, but you're running it on your computer, typically. So you get to run it at home on your own hardware. That's what Stable Diffusion is. But the negative prompt thing is interesting because, like, if a negative prompt, this isn't going to work very well, but say, just tell it, don't make mistakes. So that's a negative prompt. You're telling it something to not do. So I guess in this case, he would say, don't ever depict adults. And there's probably more to it than that, but that's what he did. So that way, anything that it was trying to do, it would then make sure that they were less than adults. All right. And that produced, according to the government, hundreds of images. But here's the concession that I think is load-bearing, is the load-bearing wall of the entire operation. And there's a footnote, footnote number two. It says, the government concedes that the images for which Anderegg is charged do not depict an actual child, nor can they be linked to an actual child. They cite the oral argument for it at the 21 minute and 43 second mark. So the government stood up in open court and said, these are not real children.
They did that, and that concession is everything, because the whole architecture of child porn law rests on the presence of a real child. Now, that's not the case when it comes to solicitation. You can be soliciting a fake minor, but if you're producing porn, it has to be a real child. So let me lay the precedent the way the panel did, because they walked through it carefully, and I want the listeners to have the map. You've got three Supreme Court cases involved in somewhat intention. One is Stanley versus Georgia, which we referred to in 1969 case. Cops found three reels of 8mm obscene film in the man's home. They convicted him of possession, and the Supreme Court reversed the conviction. The court held that the state's, quote, power simply does not extend to mere possession by the individual in the privacy of his own home. And then the line everybody quotes, quote, if the First Amendment means anything, it means the state has no business telling a man sitting alone in his own house what books he may read and what films he may watch.
All right, well then, so Stanley is the home possession shield. What is the second case?
Well, the second case is New York versus Ferber, 1982. That's where the Cowit carved out the child porn out of the First Amendment, whether it's obscene or not, because of the real child. The Cowit said that the state's interest in protecting kids, quote, a government objective of surpassing importance. Now, that's some of your fancy writing. And the distribution of this material is, quote, intrinsically related to the sexual abuse of children because the material is, quote, a permanent record of the children's participation in the harm and a child is exacerbated by their circulation. Now, you got to admit that there's some logic to that. That's not totally off the wall. So Ferber is about the real child and the permanent record of the child's abuse. And then third, there's Osborne versus Ohio in 1990. That's where the court extended the reach into the home. Osborne had four photographs of actual adolescents in his house, and the court said Stanley doesn't save him because, quote, the state does not rely on a paternalistic interest in regulating Osborne's mind. Rather, Ohio has enacted a statute in order to protect victims of child porn. It hopes to destroy a market for the exploitative use of children, end of quote.
Okay, right. So in Osborne, you've got real kids, a real market, a real interest in stamping it out at every level of the distribution chain. But none of those three cases is about virtual AI-generated chirrins. Where does the computer-generated stuff come into play then?
Well, none of those cases were decided before we had this technology, and that's what we have to talk about. The fourth case comes in, and that's Ashcroft versus Free Speech Coalition in 2002, which technology had evolved. Congress in 1996 had passed the Child Porn Prevention Act, the CPPA, which extended the ban to actual children, beyond actual children, to include, quote, any visual depiction, including any computer-generated image or picture that is or appears to be a minor engaging in sexual explicit conduct. And the Supreme Court struck that down. The court said that child protection rationale does not apply when there's no child. It quoted Williams, which I forget the citation on that, for the there was a case the Supreme Court decided to have Williams in the name sometime in that era. The child protection rationale for speech restriction does not apply to materials produced without children. And it said virtual child porn is not intrinsically related to sexual abuse of children, as the materials were in Ferber, because those were real children. And you got to admit, there's some logic in that.
I think so. And that's the same logic the Seventh Circuit applied here. No child, no Ferber, no Osborne?
Correct. Because the government conceded there was no actual child. I bet they won't do that again. They'll say, Your Honor, we have not been able to completely figure out what these they could be children. And we're still, of course, I would say, well, then you've refiled the cases when you get it figured out. but they conceded no actual child. The panel said Ferber and Osborne do not directly apply to this case. Those two are off the table. All you've got is Stanley, the Home Possession Shield and Free Speech Coalition, which says the state's justifications for banning virtual material don't hold up. And there's where the opinion gets, I say, delicious, because the government came in and set forth arguments of why they should be able to ban the stuff. And the panel put those arguments side by side with the government's case that they lost 20 years plus ago. Same argument, same brief, 23 years apart. Didn't change the wording. Admit that's funny. They just copied and pasted a brief from 23 years ago. Funny, right?
Yeah, totally. All right. Well, wait. They literally compared the briefs. Could you take us through that? Because that part made me, that did make me laugh out loud. And all the people on the train were laughing at me, like pointing like, what is this guy? What's wrong with this guy?
Yeah, they literally quoted the briefs side by side. So the government's first argument was grooming, which we talked about earlier. The offenders used this material to groom minors. The panel acknowledged that's a real phenomena. Cited congressional finding that grooming risk is, quote, the same whether the imagery shows actual or computer-generated children. But then the panel said we cannot ignore the Supreme Court flatly rejected that same argument. Remember, they're inferior. They're the Court of Appeals. And it quoted Free Speech Coalition. And that quote says the government may not prohibit speech because it increases the chance an unlawful act will be committed at some indefinite future time. And I've said that a long time. The registry might prevent a crime. It might. I'm not saying it will, but it might. But we can't do it because we don't do preventative things in this country. Then the second argument, normalization, that engaging with the material normalizes sex with children. And the panel said Free Speech Coalition, quote, is on all fours, and quoted, and then they, without a significantly stronger, more direct connection, the government may not prohibit speech on the ground that it may encourage pedos to engage in illegal conduct, because they're speculating. We can't do that in this country.
And this is where the side-by-side comes in?
That's where it comes in the footnote. In the next, the panel wrote that instead of providing more support, the government, quote, merely restates the same arguments made in Free Speech Coalition. And then it did compare. In 2001, the government's brief argued Congress found that, quote, child porn is often used as a method of seducing other children into sexual activity, and that computer-generated images, quote, can be used as effective in seducing children into sexual and photographic images of real children. They don't learn. And then in the 25 brief in Andrig, quote, offenders may use images of the type that Andrig possessed, like they commonly use similar type images showing children to groom minors into engaging in sexually explicit conduct. Same argument. They plow from 2002 into being dragged into the same thing. Hey, guys, using AI is great, but kind of twist it around a little bit and try to make it sound like you wrote it. It'll help you a lot with the court.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for the government for a second, because they had two other arguments that I thought were their clever plays. One was the interstate commerce hook. They said that, look, this isn't just a guy sitting at home like Stanley, because to convict under this statute, we have to prove the material or the computer crossed state lines. So Stanley shouldn't apply because there's a commerce nexus. And what did the court do with that line of thinking?
The court didn't do too much with it. And I love how they did it. The government said Stanley doesn't apply where the conduct was, quote, facilitated through the use of commerce. That doesn't make sense. Did you write that again?
I did.
and noted that trial, they noted at trial, it, quote, intends to prove that the computer that Andrig used to produce and possess his image had traveled in interstate commerce, and that he had downloaded stable diffusion from the internet. Now, you got to give him credit. They at least tried to make the connection. And the sure. panel said that doesn't change anything. They said the interstate commerce requirement does not change the fact that the government is using 1466 AD4 to punish Andrig for possessing obscene material in his own home.
All right, well, then this is the part that I wanted to dig on you on, because reels of film cross state lines too. They end up in the mail carrier's pouch and it goes on a truck and then goes from Ohio to Kansas or wherever it goes. So Stanley's 8mm films didn't grow in his living room. It's not a chia pet.
Well, and they addressed that. They said obviously Matthews and Stanley almost certainly moved in interstate commerce too. And it didn't matter to the Supreme Court. The panel said once the materials left the public sphere and entered the home, the government's regulatory power was eclipsed by the individual's First Amendment, and then, quote Stanley, right to receive information and ideas regardless of the social worth. And there's a footnote in 5 where they said that. And so they didn't do very well on this argument. Guys, you got to do a little bit more work. You need to call me before you submit your next brief.
So the Commerce Nexus got shoved into a footnote as a jurisdictional afterthought. What was the government's other clever play?
Oh, well, they don't give up easily. The other one was read Stanley narrowly. They say it only protects obscene material depicting adults, not children. And then they leaned on a line from the Williams case that I don't have the full citation for, where the court said, quote, we have held that the government may criminalize the possession of child porn, even though it may not criminalize the mere possession of obscene material involving adults. So the government seized on those words involving adults and said, see, Stanley's about adults. And the panel said, no, you're overreading a sentence. The language of an opinion is not always to be parsed through, well, we are dealing with the language of the statute. And more fundamentally, the reasoning of Stanley did not turn to the contents of the obscene material. Rather, its holding is predicated on the location in the home. That's the catch that they adopted here. Seems like they're respecting what you can do in your own home, which a lot of people have forgotten, that you're supposed to have the privacy to do a lot of things in your own home.
Okay. All right. Well, then, so to get the concession point head on, because it feels like the whole thing is balanced on one admission. The whole thing turns on the government admitting these are not real children. And if they had changed this as morphed images of real kids, does Anderegg lose?
I don't know. The whole thing hangs on no actual child at the moment. Pull that thread, and if they can, I don't know what they're going to do with this opinion, but the opinion tells you, remember Free Speech Coalition. Distinguish the morphing provision. Footnote 3, it lays out, although morphed images may fall within the definition of virtual child porn, they implicate the interest of real children, and they are, in that sense, closer to images than Ferber. So if you take a real child's innocent photograph and morph it into something sexually explicit, now you've got a real child's interest implicated, and you're back to Ferber and Osborne, not Free Speech Coalition. This case only comes out this way because the government conceded there was no real child ever. There was no morphing. There was no real child ever. It was created from scratch.
And that brings me to the thing that really made me uneasy about calling this a win. It wasn't a unanimous, confident, this is the law opinion. The panel kept apologizing for its own ruling. Did I catch that interpretation right?
You're reading it mostly right, and that's why I say don't get too giddy. The panel telegraphed misgivings all the way through. Early on, they wrote, we have some concerns about the lines these cases draw, but we are not free to redraw them ourselves. And then near the end, the money quote from the whole distrust reading, we have some misgivings about applying Free Speech Coalition here. But unless we wish to anarchy to prevail within the federal judicial system, we're duty-bound to follow it. And I've told you guys this, the audience, in previous episodes. If you're at a lower-level court, you have a duty to follow precedent. And they cite Hutto versus Davis. A precedent of this court must be followed by lower federal courts, no matter how misguided the judges on the courts think them to be.
And they followed Free Speech Coalition on that, but you could hear the reluctance.
I did. They followed Free Speech Coalition with a gun to their head, and you could hear them apologizing for it. And I don't think that's a court that really believes in the result. The court said it believes in the chain of command. So it's inviting it to go back up.
And then, I think that gets us to the concurrence. And this is the part that flipped my whole read of the case, because two of the three judges, Judge Lee and Judge Kohler, wrote separately, and the concurrence isn't defending the ruling. It's asking the Supreme Court come to fix it. Now, let me read it. Quote, I write separately to note that given the significant advances in computer-generated image technology, particularly in the field of artificial intelligence, we would benefit from additional guidance from the Supreme Court regarding the intersection between the First Amendment and virtual CSAM if an appropriate case should arise. So two of the three judges just held up a sign that says, please take this case.
Yep. Two of the three judges wrote separately, basically asking the Supreme Court to fix it, because it's there ultimately. It's the panel following what the Supreme Court told them to do. And a win for two of the three judges, it's a win, but they're basically saying, hey, you know, we didn't want to do this, and if you don't like it, you need to do something about it, which means that invited the government to appeal. And the concurrence doesn't stop at that. It practically drafts the government's petition. It quotes Justice O'Connor and Justice Thomas from Free Speech Coalition, predicting this exact day. Thomas wrote, if technological advances thwart prosecution of unlawful speech, the government may well have a compelling interest in barring otherwise or otherwise regulating some narrow category of lawful speech in order to enforce effectively laws against prawn made through the abuse of real children. The concurrence pulled that quote out. So they are not happy about what they did.
All right. And then there's this training data piece, which I want you to explain, because this is the part of the concurrence flags as the argument the government didn't make. Quote, a major data set used for training image generating AI contained hundreds of CSAM images. And then, quote, the market for AI generated virtual CSAM images may impact the demand for actual CSAM on which the AI models can train. Such a finding would implicate many of the concerns raised in Osborne. So it isn't just a blueprint for the next prosecution.
Yep, that's what they said, and that's the crack which the state could reenter. And the concurrence held the flashlight up to it, and it's not the state, it's the federal government. But here's the logic. Free Speech Coalition said virtual material isn't linked to real children, but if the AI model that generated that material was itself trained on a real CSAM, then you can argue that there's a market connection back to real children, real abuse, and so forth. And that's an Osborne argument, which we talked about earlier, market for real kids, not the Free Speech Coalition argument. The concurrence flat out said, in this case, the record is insufficient to evaluate these complex issues. Translation, the government didn't build the record here, but somebody should build it next time. And that's where this is going. They're going to build this next time.
And then the next prosecutor reads this opinion and does what?
Develops the record the concurrence told them to develop, puts on evidence about training data sets, which I don't understand, puts on evidence about the market for actual CSAM, slots the case into Osborne instead of Free Speech Coalition. They forget about that case, and I'd expect possibly a different postured case with a record that could flip the result. That's what I'm seeing possibly.
And on the Congress side, you keep saying this pattern repeats. Could you lay that out? Because the opinion actually narrates the last time it happened?
Yes, the opinion laid it out. The Congress passed the CPPA in 1996. The Supreme Court struck it down in Free Speech Coalition. And then after Free Speech Coalition, Congress went back to the drawing board and enacted a statute that wasn't here. It's called the PROTECT Act of 2003. So the pattern is loose or lose. Redraft, come back, and redraft the added obscenity element, and that's what they're going to do. And I expect them to add more findings, morphing findings, training data findings, whatever they can think survives the next challenge, and they're going to pass new laws in Congress after this.
And I'll ask the question our audience is actually going to ask, though. Does this ruling touch the registry at all, or is this just a First Amendment possession case that just happens to walk through our neighborhood?
It doesn't touch the registry. It just walks through our neighborhood. This is a First Amendment possession holding. The court's conclusion, quote, we conclude that 1466 A.B. 1 is unconstitutional as applied to indirect. And that's about whether the government can criminalize in home possession of this particular type of material that's not a real child. It's not a registry case, not a residency case, not a supervision case. It's just about First Amendment.
And then give me your bottom line. Is this a win or is it not a win?
It's a narrow, hollow win for the moment. The Seventh Circuit affirmed the dismissal to possession count, and so that's a solid win on that one count. And I don't see how they can bring that back now. But the panel refused to redraw the Supreme Court's lines, and they're following their protocols about the court. The panel telegraphed misgivings, and above all, the concurrence, two of the three judges openly inviting the Supreme Court to revisit this doctrine. So, nope.
How much weight does that have? Two of the three judges openly asking the Supreme Court to revisit. How much weight does that carry in them taking a case?
It carries a lot because normally when you're doing, there's two steps you can do. You can do a motion to hear the case on bank. And you usually just cite to the one dissent that you like that would have gone your way. This time, you've got two judges on the three-judge panel to cite to. You can say, they only did this because they had a gun to their head. That's the only reason they did this. So this is much more significant. So it gets them either a full court review or they do a cert petition to the Supreme Court directly off of this.
All right. And then this protects Anderegg on possession today, but it doesn't settle the law.
It does protect Anderegg on possession today. It doesn't settle the law. And it doesn't stop the government from coming back stronger. This is well-plowed earth, as they say in the South. And the plow is rusting, but the government is already sharpening a new one. It's a good ruling for now.
All right, then I'm going to try to filter some questions that people have asked in chat. So couldn't the no child, no crime be somehow applied to sting operations?
I don't know. I got to think about that. The way the statutes are usually drafted, they have covered that. Saying or a person acting as a child, pretending to be or depicted as a child, or however they word it in various statutory schemes. So they don't say that in these statutory schemes. They don't say if you're looking at prawn or anything that has been designed to make you think it's prawn, child prawn. So I don't know if it would hold the same type of persuasive powers, because it would totally shut down the sting operations. Because there's actually very few people out there trying to solicit a minor.
Right. I'm intrigued here they're going to, at some point in time, they're speaking about going after the training data and all that stuff, which, to explain it to you in analog senses, everything that you know about law is something that you have read. So to teach a computer how to analyze law, draw images, write computer program, you feed it what is called training data, which is examples of what you're trying to get it to do. And that's how it learns. Hey, Larry, how did you learn how to write your first brief? You didn't just make it up on your own one day. You followed what someone else had done. And then eventually you internalize it and it becomes yours in your own version format. You like to put things centered this way, whatever, the font you like to use. That's how it becomes yours. But you still learned from someone else. And the whole internet is that. And that's what training data is. And so it'll be interesting on how they would ever crack down on just that the internet exists. And you can certainly find adult people that look childish, and you could extrapolate from that. You could turn that into whatever you wanted it to be. You know what I mean?
I'm sure you could, but that makes it a little more understandable to me, because that's exactly how we do learn, or did learn, was we would take briefs. And in the old days, before we had these elaborate ways of copying and pasting, we would take the brief and we would take it and type it up on the old-fashioned computer. And that's what we did. But now we just copy and paste, and not when we'll do that, we just tell the AI to generate a brief, and then we fix it after we get the product.
Hopefully. There's plenty of stuff coming out where people aren't checking it afterwards. And they have citations to court cases that do not exist. They look perfect. They'll say, you know, U.S. Seventh Circuit, whatever, paragraph this, and doesn't exist. It completely fabricated, but it looks right, and it looks convincing.
It does, and we've got a letter that we might go over next week from a person that's asked you a question. It's out of my domain, but yours about AI. So I'll put that in next week if I can condense it down to something understandable. But yeah, that's how we did. We learn from what other people have done. We don't reinvent the wheel.
I mean, I'm gonna trash the expression. I'm not great. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. Something like that. Nobody, Jeff Bezos, nobody has done quote unquote anything by themselves except for the first guy that made fire. You know, back in your day, the first guy, somebody in your clan, they struck the two rocks together and they made fire. That guy is the first.
Well, how do you know that they did it that way? How do you know that they didn't just see a lightning strike, sort of fire, and they said,
wonder what caused that? So everyone is standing on the shoulders of all those that came before them to do all the things that they've done. I rest my case. Nope, you're perfectly right.
So.
And all right, anything before we head out?
No, this was kind of fun, except it was complicated.
But yeah, it seems kind of wrapping around your elbow to get to your posterior.
It was very difficult trying to figure out all this stuff because it's out of my area of expertise.
I have a quick question for you because there's an individual that I communicate that is in a prison in the Northeast. And it turns out, so I end up getting an email from his sister telling me that he won't be calling for a while because he's on phone restriction. And I wanted to get your opinion on this, that he didn't like suitcase a phone. He wasn't fighting. All those things. He wasn't selling contraband. He lost phone privileges because he was feeding the pigeons. And I'm just like, I mean, I can see pigeon, like there's a sanitary aspect here, but you lose your phone privileges for feeding the pigeons?
Well, it does seem extreme at first blush, but we don't know how many times he'd been asked. We don't know the severity of the pigeon infestation. We don't know if they've had to deal with medical issues related to sicknesses. There's a lot we don't know. And we don't know how many previous write-ups he's had for other stuff that finally they said, we're tired of dealing with you. But just that standing alone, yes, it seems very extreme to give someone restrictions for feeding the pigeons.
I can't. It's just, well, that's prison for you. All right. Well, I'm done. Head over to registrymatters.co. Wow, I started in the wrong place. Registrymatters.co. You can find show notes and links to everywhere you want to go. You can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can leave an old-fashioned voicemail message, 747-227-4477. And as the few dozens of people that are listening to us live, you can do that if you sign up at patreon.com/registrymatters. It is incredibly helpful to us and showing the love and support and helps us stay motivated to keep doing this kind of program. And then if you want to buy some swag, if you don't want to become a patron, you could head over to fypeducation.org/shop and you can find very cool merch like our Kabuki Machine shirt that is right there if you're looking at the screen. It's a very cool picture and I really appreciate 010 Brands for helping us put that stuff online. And Larry, I hope you have a fine, fantabulous Labor Day weekend. And you want to tell me a quick little story? How did Labor Day come to be?
I don't have any idea. You tell me.
All right, then. Well, I'm done. I don't have any answers for you. 40-hour work week. That's where it comes from.
So, we've sold about 100 of those Kabuki Machine shirts, I think, right?
It's been a very good seller. And somebody asked to have it put on the back of the shirt, so we made that happen, and they got their shirt made with the thingamajigger on the back, and all is well. So Larry, I hope you have a great weekend and stay cool and whatnot, and I hope your air conditioner is working, and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.